Hi, I'm Robert Tagone, and I'm a writer. I used to tell people that I was a lawyer turned writer, but I was actually always a writer. And I sidetracked a little bit to practice law, but writing's what I do. It's part of who I am. I grew up in California. I grew up in Northern California, a little town called Burlingame. When I grew up in Burlingame, it was a sleepy middle-class neighborhood. You know, typical of the 60s and the 70s, small, you know, two-bedroom houses, a little Catholic school down the street, little supermarket close by. And now I go down there and you hardly recognize it.
Yeah.
It's a premier place to live. It's kind of been yuppified. The two-story houses have been torn down and the big giant ones lot line to lot line. And so it's funny. I used to always think I wanted to live in Burlingame. Yeah. But the Burlingame I knew as a kid doesn't exist anymore.
What's your memory of growing up around books or words or language or communication? How did you get started?
Oh, you know, it's funny. I tell a story now. I call it pulling weeds. Because when I was a kid, my mother, I'm one of 10 kids. Yeah. And my mother did not have time to entertain us or the energy or the desire. She was fabulous at just, you know, keeping us, you know, under wraps and everything. But one of the things she'd do is if she had these sayings, you'd say, Mom, I'm cold. She'd say, put a sweater on. I'm not heating the neighborhood. And if you ever said, I'm bored, she'd say, read a book. And your only other option was to go out and pull weeds in the ice plant. We had this massive thing in the middle of the road. We lived on sort of a horseshoe. And in the middle was this big bed of ice plant. And my mother would make us weed it. And it was like it was a fate worse than death when you're a kid. So I chose reading. And my mother was an English major, and when she was a child, her mother used to say to her, you know, stop reading so much, you can hurt your eyes. That's how much she read.
Right.
Well, she had all these great books. So by the time I was in the seventh grade, I mean, I had read The Count of Monte Cristo and The Old Man and the Sea, Of Mice and Men, all of those, The Red Badge of Courage, The Great Gatsby. I'd read all those books, and I just thought, well, these are just great stories. I had no idea I was reading, you know, the classics from the greatest writers of, you know, American writers of our time, and I was just, you know, blown away. But to me, it was just, this is what you did. You know, you read these great books. And it's funny because I was really the only one. My brothers and sisters are all much more into math and science. They became doctors, medicine. Mm-hmm. But for me, it stuck. It stuck. And I knew by the seventh grade that what I wanted to do was words. You know, I wanted to act. I wanted to write. I wanted to speak. It was a part of me. But it came from, first, a love of books.
No, it came from hating weeding.
Yeah. Gardening.
Well, transitioning from reading to writing, do you remember your first efforts, your first stories?
Oh, yeah. Again, seventh grade, I had to get up and give a speech in front of the seventh grade class at Our Lady of Angels, yeah, Catholic school. And I, you know, I was a bit of a screw-up. You know, I don't know if I was bored or if I was just one of those kids, kind of a punk. But I spent my fair share of time in the principal's office.
Yeah.
And so when I got up to give this speech, and I spent a lot of time writing it. And it was, you could either be a slave owner, an abolitionist, or a slave. And we were studying slavery, so you had to give this speech. So I've written it from the perspective of an abolitionist. And so my friends, my classmates are going up first, and you know their speech is like 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, uh-oh, because mine's about 8 or 9.
Uh-huh.
And so I got up, you know, terrified that I had screwed up again. I was on my way back to see Sister Virginia in the principal's office, and I gave this speech. And I can remember the room becoming deadly silent. Just silent. And I remember looking out at my friends, Maddie McGuigan, Danny O'Leary, and some other of them, and seeing the look on their faces. And they were just, you know, they weren't smiling at me. They weren't laughing at me. They weren't bored. They were just sort of had that look of, you know. And I started getting the impression that maybe I was doing okay. And then I finished, and Sister Kathleen, who was sitting in the back, standing in the back of the classroom, she didn't do anything. And nobody clapped. There was no applause. There was nothing. It was just this dead silence. And suddenly she looked at me and she just went like this. And I really didn't know what to expect. I really didn't know what to think. And she took me outside into the corridor, the breezeway. And she walked me down the breezeway to the other seventh grade class. There were two classes per grade. And I walked, stood there, and she walked in. She came back out. She grabbed me, put me back up, and said, "Do your speech again." And that's when I knew.
It was the encore that got you, huh?
You know, I just knew it.
Yeah.
And I can remember when I stood up the second time, I started to act. I started to use my voice, and I'd lower my voice at certain points. And I remember this because I remember Sister Kathleen saying to me, "Speak up." So I knew I was doing it deliberately, on purpose.
Yeah.
But I also remember thinking, this is so cool. This is so much fun. And I love theater. I did a lot of theater, and I love it. And it's another passion, but it's a jealous mistress. It's a really tough thing to do when you're married and have kids, because you're working nights and you're working weekends. And, you know, there's a trade-off. And,
yeah.
And I wasn't willing to make that trade-off at some point in my life when I had to make a decision. But it goes back to that level of words, really.
Do you ever think about possibly writing drama?
I've tried.
Yeah.
But, you know, what I've come to realize is writing is hard, which is why not everybody does it. Anybody can sit at a typewriter and write words, but to write well and to create novels is hard. It's why people go to school. You know, and I always laugh, and I always say this at places where I teach. I'll say, if I handed you the violin and say, "Play the violin," what would you tell me? "I don't know how to play the violin." "Well, just play it from your heart. Play it from your heart and it'll be great." Well, but people seem to think that that's what we do as writers. Well, we just write from our heart. We don't have any training, we don't have any background, any experience, any education. We just write from our heart. Well, you do write from your heart. But, you know, Michelangelo sculpted from his heart. And the great painters painted, and Mozart, you know, composed from his heart. But Mozart also had a father who was instructing him from the time he was 2 years old. And Michelangelo was one of the greatest studiers of human anatomy ever. You know, and so art is born out of perspiration. And it's that hard work. And so when people say, you know, "Would you ever consider writing a screenplay?" Well, I did write one, and it was terrible, which is what I expect it to be, because I haven't studied screenplay. And it's almost an insult to the people that write screenplays, that have gone to school, that have taken 3 years to learn the craft, to learn the art, to learn how to do it, and then they bring their art to that craft. So would I love to write plays? Yeah. Do I have the time to learn how to do it correctly? No.
You know, we all as writers know, and I'm sure you've had the experience yourself of when somebody finds out you're a writer, of saying, "I have the greatest idea for a book. Would you like it?"
I get that all the time.
Yeah.
I get that all the time. I get people now that'll email me from all over the country or call me. And, you know, I always encourage it, because you never know. And I'm always looking for nonfiction work. Mm-hmm. You know, my first book was nonfiction. I'm always looking for that next nonfiction story. And it's hard to find that right story.
Mm-hmm.
But they... You do get a lot of people saying, you know, "I got this great idea."
Within us, all of us, there are stories.
Yeah.
And that is what some of us do better than others, is to convey that story in some form or another.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's been, you know, forever. You know, forever people have sat around and said, "Once upon a time."
See the Herzog movie of the cave paintings?
Yeah, I've read about it.
It's the story.
Yeah.
It's the story.
Yeah. And, you know, it's how we communicate. It's how we entertain. And, you know, that's why, you know, people are worried about the future of the book and the future of reading. And, you know, my response is the next generation, the younger generation, my kids and their kids, as much as we continue to provide them with good stories, they'll always continue to read, you know, because I think it's innate in us. I once read an article. I'm not this smart, but I just once read an article about the difference between watching TV and reading. And it was very, very interesting because, you know, reading is interactive. You have to engage the characters. You have to create the characters in your mind. You have to see the characters in your mind. You have to hear their voices. You have to smell the things that they're smelling, touch the things that they're touching. TV does all that for you. You just sit there and it just bombards you. Boom, 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 boom with information. And you just sort of let it come at you. it's not the same thing. It's not the same process. Our brains don't work the same way when we're reading and when we're watching TV. So I don't think they have to be exclusive one or the other. You know, I think there's a place for both. I love movies. Mm-hmm. I love going to movies. It's a passion of mine.
Yeah.
And I go and I love to see how they've been put together, how the story unfolds, how creative the screenwriter has been in having a twist that I didn't see coming. You know, all that stuff. So, I don't think that they have to be exclusive.
Yeah. As a successful, best-selling writer, you've never had the experience of getting a rejection note or letter. So, but could you think of what other people who are writers must feel like when they get one?
I've received probably upwards of 50 to 75 rejection letters. My first novel, The Jury Master, was rejected everywhere. And, you know, part of that was it had a lot of the first-time novel mistakes in it. And part of it is just you're new. No one knows who you are, and they're not willing to take a chance on you. They want to love the material. And, I had the benefit of having a good quality education that I could put on my resume that, you know, stood out, and a professional career that stood out. But the bottom line was it comes down to the writing. And the writing wasn't good enough. And it wasn't until I made that realization, came to that realization, that it's not good enough. See, I had a blessing and a curse. The blessing was I got an agent right away. Sent out 5 query letters, and one of the 5 called. I want to sign you. This is exactly the kind of stuff I do.
Well, having completed
that novel and sent that out and was on work on the next one. Mm-hmm. And then he died, which was, you know, there's a story behind all that. But, you know, obviously tragic for him, and it ended up being, you know, fortuitous for me, because I began to realize that I wasn't ready. That book wasn't ready to go out. And so I went back and then began to really teach myself the craft. Steve Barry says, if anyone tells you they can teach you to write, they're lying. No one can teach you to write. They can only teach you how to teach yourself how to write. And what he means by that is they can teach you, you know, what books to go get. They can teach you the craft of, you know, story structure and point of view and voice and all that stuff. But at some point, you either can put words together in a way that make people cry, laugh, you know, shout out, enjoy, whatever, or you can't. But you know, it's that teaching process that's important.
What has been the highest point for you, the most successful point for you in feedback about your writing?
You know, I could say it's the first time I opened up, you know, the package from the publisher and I saw The Jury Master for the first time. I could say it's when my agent called me and said, you know, this is the phone call every agent likes to give their authors. You're on the New York Times bestseller list.
Boy.
You know, and all those things are fabulous, but I still think it comes down to the email I got from the woman in Kentucky who emailed me at like 11 o'clock Seattle time and said, I'm on page 100 and I forget what it is, 43 in Bodily Harm, and I've read all your books and I loved your writing, but I can't believe you just did what you did, and I'm not finishing this book and I'm not reading you ever again.
Ooh.
And I took a huge jump in Bodily Harm. I mean, I did something that most writers would never do. And so I knew where she was coming from. So I emailed her back that night and said, you know, I'm sorry you feel that way. Let me explain to you why I did what I did and where I was at, what point in my life I was at when I wrote it. And I explained it to her and I went to bed. And I got up the next morning and there was an email at about 3:15 Seattle time. And she said, so very kind of you to write me back. You know, thank you so much for letting me know. But I finished your book at three o'clock this morning anyway. Thanks. You know, and for me, that was just such a gratifying moment, because what it said was that my writing was strong enough that even under those circumstances, she was drawn back to it.
Wonderful.
It was a really great feeling.
That's great testament.
And it moved her. I mean, she was really upset with me. Yeah. Which means she was upset with the book. I mean, it was the character. It wasn't because the book
connected.
Was bad. It was she was so connected to the characters that when I did what I did, it really hurt her.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Nice. Could we take a look at where you write?
Yeah, absolutely.
Excellent. Elvis, huh?
Yeah.
Tell me about Elvis.
I've always been a fan. My father was a fan.
Yeah.
Elvis Presley. And so I was a fan when I was younger. And, you know, I was a... He died a tragic death. And he died sort of a caricature. But when you look back at what he did at 20 years of age, I mean, basically took an entire music industry and said, I don't care how things have been done in the past. This is how I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, he was like Jackie Robinson in baseball.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he broke barriers. And to do it at that age, you know, this young guy from Tuscaloosa, Mississippi, or whatever it is,
right.
Tuscaloosa, Mississippi, I just thought, wow. You know, for an artist, he's sort of the standard bearer, I think. Oh. You know what I mean? So, you know, and if I surround myself with a collection of eclectic things. The Leaning Tower of Pisa was taken by a dear friend, Ed Vendetti, who died of a heart attack at 43 years of age. Loved him. He was a wonderful man. And that's hard. These are all photos of New York City that I bought when my wife and I were in New York for my first trip there when they were I was meeting with different publishers for the Cyanide Canary, and uh-huh. You know, it always kind of reminds me of, you know, that's kind of where the publishing industry is.
Yeah, that's right.
And then, you know, a lot of the stuff on the walls is just, you know, I don't have all the books framed, but, you know, they're knickknacks of my life.
This is where the great thoughts come,
yeah.
Huh?
Yeah. Here it is. Start out when I'm writing. I start out every day reading from The Green Mile, Stephen King.
Yeah.
I've probably read it 35 times. I'm on the end again because I'm nearing the end of my own book. So I'll read the Green Mile. And off I go. And I tell people now, the two screens is probably the greatest thing that's happened since my family got me a GPS.
Now, how do you do that?
Well, they're set up in such a way that I can be working on the manuscript. So here's the latest manuscript that I'm working on, right?
Yeah.
And say I want to get on the internet, and the internet's here.
And research.
So I pull up whatever research I need, and I can go right back to this screen, and I can literally just type it in. So the other day I was trying to find this waterfall that I had researched when I was up in the Gold Country for this book, and you know, I just didn't feel like I had good pictures of it, and I didn't feel like I had, you know, documented it well enough when I was taking notes and doing research. So I pulled it up, and I read about it.
And without disturbing what you're writing.
Yeah, without kind of losing,
oh, yes,
you know, losing the process or having to, you know, I know that there's a screen behind each screen, but
yeah.
For me, it's just, it's simpler, it's easier.
Yeah.
So I always tell people, you know, I laugh and my wife said, I'll get you a second screen. I was like, I'm a writer. What the heck do I need two screens for, right? But I'll tell you, it makes a big difference.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah. I haven't seen anybody else doing that.
It makes a big difference.
And so, do you have a particular time of the day that you like to write?
Well, I write, I pretty much write, you know, all day.
Okay.
I write full time. But I'm much more creative in the morning than I am in the afternoon. I mean, I can feel, you know, like this morning I was able to sit down and just go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I went for, you know, two and a half hours this morning, and the words were just coming. But I know that I would reach a point, you know, where they just stop.
Yeah.
And then what you got to do, what I have to do, because I'm writing, this is the first draft, is you just got to force through. And you say to yourself, okay, I know this isn't great. And I know I'm going to go back and change this. I know I'm going to go back and edit this. And I'm going to rephrase it. But you got to get to the end of that first draft. And so you just push through to the end of that first draft. And then, you know, with experience, you begin to realize, you know, I'm more creative in the morning. I'm not as creative in the afternoon. So I'm not going to get as much accomplished in the afternoon as I do in the morning. Like I said, once I get through this first draft and kind of really begin to understand what I have, then, you know, then it all changes. Then the editing process goes, you know, comes into play, and you know, that's another reason for the two screens, because you can have, as you're working on your second draft, you can have your first draft up on the screen, and you can kind of see what you're doing and how you're changing it.
Very nice.
So that helps too.
So, Robert, What inspirational thoughts would you give to prospective, aspiring, hopeful writers?
I'll give them one inspirational one because it was given to me by a friend, so it's not mine. And this was given to him by his father when he told his father he wanted to leave IBM and become a photographer, an artist. And he's a brilliant, brilliant artist now, known throughout the world. And Mike said to me, his father told him, follow your dreams and the money will come. Follow the money and you lose your dreams.
Nice.
And it's really something that I think we all need to live by, because it's really this, what he's saying is, you know, don't get caught up in the strappings. Don't get caught up in the things. Get, you know, immerse yourself in the art and you'll be fine. Beyond that, I always tell people, writers write. We can come up with 1,000 excuses a day why you're not writing. 1,000 excuses, you know, you're too busy, you got kids, you got this, you got that. But this is what we do for a living. It would be like a dentist not working on people's teeth and saying, well, I'm a dentist, but I'm really too busy to be a dentist. You know, you write, and that's what we do as writers. And so you have to write. You have to put words down on paper. You have to put words on a screen and then go from there.
Robert, this has been wonderful. Your inspirational talks that you've given, that I've heard you at Willamette Writers, have always been astounding.
Thank you.
And, I mean, you end up with standing ovations from hundreds and hundreds of people for a good reason.
It's a nice feeling.
Yeah. It's nice feeling. Because you had that damned seventh grade drama stuff.
You know, I think when you come from a big family, I think the ego gets beaten out of you at a pretty young age. And you begin to realize that, you know, everybody out there is the same as you are.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of us are just a little bit more blessed. And I've been very blessed in this career.
Yeah.
You know, I've had my share of ups and downs. But, you know, I'm doing what I love to do. And I try not to forget that. And I try not to forget there are a lot of people out there that are struggling. And just like I was. And I got a lot of help from other writers. So I do my best to help them.
Nice. Well, you've done a great job here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right. God, great.